So yesterday in Taisho, we went into a kind of practice called Tsen. In Chan Buddhism, it's called Tsen, T-S-E-N, which means boring into. You might think of it as drilling down. This is the primary practice we do in Sesshin because we're very taken care of here. We don't have to concern ourselves with various tasks and things that occupy our thinking mind. So we have the luxury, you might say, of being able to penetrate very deeply. And this is actually a core aspect of our training, is this boring into. So just to remind you, if you recall, we talked about the koan mu as an example. And the reason that mu is so valuable is that it deals with a sensation that is already completely intimate, which is the sensation of thinking. So you think the thought of mu, not one iota is outside you. So any time your thoughts start to wander out in that direction, mu brings it back to something intimate. And then at some point, you notice that this mu appears and you enter into that intimate space deeper and deeper. So this process is called to tsen, to bore into. It can be quite burdensome and difficult. Sometimes it's described, the sensation, and these are just wonderfully colorful, and any practitioner like those in this room and those who aren't practitioners wouldn't understand it, but those in this room would get it immediately that this is like trying to bite your way into an iron bowl sometimes. Sometimes it's described as carrying around 1,000-pound weight, or like a rat gnawing into a coffin. This kind of continuous probing effort, which involves a letting go of the things that we're so easily drawn to, which is externals, ideas, concepts, and pulling the mind back into itself. This is a daunting task, but it's one that we must do to uncover this Buddha mind. So this is in Zen called holding fast. Another way it's described in Zen literature is an upwards movement. It's moving upwards. Now, there's a problem with this. It's not balanced. And that's okay at this point, because as a person that Richard Clark used to quote, William James, he said, "The road of extremes leads to the palace of wisdom." Yet, this is not the end of suffering. It's very easy for something to infect this approach. So Zen has most compassionately shown us, held up to us, and presented as a practice the opposite side, which is called letting go, or alternatively, a downwards movement. So the upwards movement would be towards the image of a sky overhead, which is vast emptiness. And a downward movement is to the earth and forms and particularities and all the things we find in this plane, all the beings. So we really need to be a complete person, know how to do both sides, even though we may choose one or the other side given the circumstances or some koan we're working on or whatever stage we might be at in our practice or what it is we need to accomplish. But we have to have facility in both. So today I wanted to talk about this other side of practice. So I thought I would start with something written by a Zen master who recently died. His name is Katsuki Sekida. He wrote a couple of wonderful books. From one of these books I'm going to read now, this is his commentary on a koan in the Hekigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record. And I'm only going to read a part of it. And this is the part that I just mentioned about the upward movement. So he says here, the upward route is the way to enlightenment. It must be understood that there is no end to the process of enlightenment. It goes on endlessly, and that is what is meant by the cultivation of holy Buddhahood. Both are capitalized, holy Buddhahood. You must not stop at the top of the 100-foot pole. It is a subtle and profound practice. Sometimes you must come down from the pole and re-enter the busy world of the ordinary activity of consciousness. Sometimes you must proceed a step further upward. It is not an easy matter. There are no rules. You have to establish your own practices. No one can teach you the way upward. Everything must come from within yourself. For this reason, no two masters have ever given the same answer to the question, what is Buddha? They have said, the bamboo root on the back mountain. Or, fire boys come asking for fire. Or, what is the price of wheat at the market? Or, the three-legged donkey goes moving its hooves. That's his description of this practice, which includes upward and downward. Now, I want to just say a little bit about these habits that can infect our practice, just so we really know what it is that we are dealing with and how important it is to develop and really grasp this other side of practice, which is letting go, not just holding fast. So, some of us have had the good fortune to have encountered, because of favorable circumstances, let's say, this particular practice at a young age. In my case, I began my practice on my own at age 19. Now, someone who started much later might say, oh, you've got a big head start on me. I wish that I could have started at age 19. And think of how far I could have gone by now. But in actuality, there's a problem with starting when you're young. You're given this tool of holding fast, but you don't have any wisdom at this point. What do I mean by wisdom? It's the wisdom of having lived for a long enough time that you begin to learn a couple of things. One, very simply, nobody's perfect. And two, no matter what something might be with all its imperfections, it is still worthy of love. It's very difficult for a young person to really get that, and thereby not develop bad habits in their early practice. Now, it's particularly difficult for someone young who can fairly easily, because of an open mind and perhaps their own unique abilities, do this holding fast, this tsen, this going down into the center, or what Sekida called the upwards movement. Because one feels a great benefit from doing this, but something intrudes on that process. Something knocks at the door. You might call it a party crasher. Something tries to get its way in to this process of just coming to a clear, no form, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, absolute intimacy. And that's all the places that you imagine you are lacking. You don't have it. Even worse, you don't deserve it. Because deep inside you know that you're a bad person, or whatever it might be. A lacking person, a defective person, an injured person. There were things you never got that had you gotten them you would be okay, but you didn't get them, so now you find yourself having to do this extremely difficult, almost impossible practice. And this intrudes. It knocks on the door and it doesn't wait for you to answer. It crashes the party, like the movie Wedding Crashers. It bursts in and pulls you out of that space you so avidly want to enter even more deeply and remain. Now, this is not unique to one or two young people taking up a practice like this. It's actually very, very common. That's why when we look around us in the world of people, those who seem most easily drawn to zealotry, extremism, anarchy, terrorism, are young people. They are shown a picture, an image of perfection, and not having the wisdom to know that nobody's perfect in that way that we want to think of perfect. And that perfection isn't quite my notion of perfection. But if they're taught in a different way, then they become zealots. They want to destroy, get rid of, eliminate the party crasher. And often this gets projected outwards into the world, where what they fear most or what they hate most about the internal party crasher, they see in others and want to get rid of that. Singing, dancing, lust, transsexuals in the military. Need I go on? All right, we really get this now. So, were that the case, that you started very young and you had some facility at Zen, at this deep probing internal practice, and also being an ordinary human being, had a party crasher and learned after a long time how to push that away, hold on to mu no matter what, like a dog holding on to a bone. Yes, this is all important. But the other side wasn't shown to you, wasn't emphasized. Even though you gradually got it, the bad habits do hang on. Now, I'll give you an example of this. My wonderful teacher, Richard Clark, when he died about 4 years ago, that was after I had spent 30 years studying with him. I felt after he died, suddenly thrust into the role of being a teacher, which, incidentally, I still don't feel ready to do, and apologize to all of you for my failings. I felt that I needed to continue work with a master. And I sought out a particular master in a tradition that wasn't too far away from my home, and stuck with that for several months. I eventually didn't continue because of certain things about the practice, the dependence upon Japanese forms and structures and hierarchy. It just didn't sit with me, especially after spending so many years with this wonderful teacher, Richard Clark. But I learned something extremely useful to me. And this came when I was started off initially on the beginning set of koan that in our own school here And what I did with Richard Clark were the preliminary koan. Now, this is after I'd already done the preliminary koan in our tradition here. They were somewhat different. There's about 100 of them, maybe more. Every school of Zen has their own particular favorites. And not only had I gone through that, but I then diligently, with Richard, went through the Mumon Kan. We actually did it twice through. And then the Hekigan Roku. And then the Book of Equanimity, which was another 100 koan. And then there were other books of koan after that. So this was a very long process, about 10 years or so. And now my teacher was gone. And I was given this set of beginner, if you want to call it that, koan. Some of which I breezed through fairly easily until very early in the list, I got tremendously hung up. I got a very simple koan. I don't believe it was on the list that I did with Richard. After I had a sufficient understanding of the koan mu. So it was somewhat new, and I thought it was quite easy. And the koan went like this. Save a ghost. That's it. Save a ghost. So I had my demonstration. No, that's not it. I'm sorry. End of conversation. Click. Well, then I made another phone call to this Roshi who was at some distance from me. Save a ghost. And I had a new take on it. No, I'm sorry, that's not it. This went on over and over for months. Why was this koan so difficult for me? Now, later on, this Roshi told me, you know, it's funny. This was extremely difficult for me, too. He said, I find that some people it comes very easily. And then there's these intellectual types for which it is very difficult. And now I have even a different perspective on it. It's not intellectual types so much as folks who have always been drawn to the holding fast. Who haven't really ever had an easy facility with what in Zen is called letting go. And so that's what I want to go into today with you, so you don't end up failing to save your ghost. So I thought to enter this discussion a little, I would read a koan to you. And this is a koan that we have gone on into maybe a couple of years ago in a Taisho. I find it to be one of, for me, the most precious koan in the Mumon Kan. And this is koan number 26. And the title of the koan is Two Monks Roll Up the Bamboo Blinds. And I'll read it to you. So the case goes like this. The monks gathered in the hall to hear the great Hogan of Seryo talk to the monks before the midday meal. Hogan pointed to the bamboo blinds which were unfolded down. At this, two monks went to the blinds and rolled them up alike. Hogan said, "One has it, the other does not." That's the koan. It's a little tough initially to probe into it, as we say, sink your teeth into it. But if you really try hard, you begin to get certain things about this. One is that there's a great teacher up there, Hogan. He was a wonderful, great teacher. He lived near the end of the Tang Dynasty. This was the master who, when he was a novitiate, on a pilgrimage, he got caught in a storm. Remember, pilgrimages were undertaken by monks who had done a lot of practice in probably had a fairly deep breakthrough, and then went on the road to visit all over China various temples and masters, learn various ways of practice so that they could deepen and broaden their insight. And he got caught in a storm and he stopped for a night in this little hut, this little small temple, and there was a teacher there, Jizo. And Jizo asked Hogan, "What is the reason for your pilgrimage?" And Hogan said, "I don't know." And Jizo then replied, "Not knowing is most intimate." This is that holding fast side. Hogan got something at that point. He knew about holding fast. Many masters get a little caught around that point, maybe most. So, coming back to this koan, Hogan, the same Hogan now, pointed to the bamboo blinds with obvious intent, I would say. And two monks went to the blinds and rolled them up alike. And then he said, and I'll paraphrase a little bit, "One of these two monks is enlightened and the other isn't." Let's just leave it at that. Let's play it that way. One of them is awakened and one of them isn't. Now, if you were sitting amongst the congregation listening to this Taisho before the midday meal, what would your mind be doing at that point? Now, you might say, "I think I know which one has it. I think I know, because when he rolled the blinds up, he was more mindful," whatever it might have been that you noticed, right? "And then the other one was a little sloppy or hesitant, maybe." So you start to make this distinction. And if that's your answer to this koan, the bell will ring and you will be out the Doksan door. So let's go into the commentary. So the commentary by Mumon goes as follows. "Tell me, which one has it and which one has not?" This is the hook. Every koan has a hook. It gets you where you're stuck. "Tell me, which one has it and which one has not?" If you have your Zen eye open at this point, you will then know how Master Seryo, which is another name for Hogan, failed. Be that as it may, you are strictly warned against arguing about has and has not. Mumon is being extremely kind to us here. He's giving us a lot of help. Now the verse, let's go right into this verse. And this is, this first line of the verse is like a very critical piece here. It's a really critical piece. "When they, the screens, are rolled up, bright and clear is the great emptiness." Then he goes on, "But the great emptiness does not yet come up to our teaching. When you cast away emptiness and everything, then it is so lucid and perfect that even the wind cannot pass through." What does this mean? One has it and the other has not. One's holding fast and the other is a party crasher. Yet, they roll up the blinds and what happens? The light comes through. How does this help us? Is there something that either of them needed to do when rolling up the blinds to get the light coming through? Did it matter how they rolled up the blinds? Did it matter if one of them slipped, hesitated? One of them was intensely mindful. Behind those blinds, the light was already shining. One of them didn't make the sunshine, and the other failed to make the sunshine, right? So what is Hogan doing here? He's kind of playing a little game to get us to realize how we ourselves attach to this holding fast, stay stuck there. We don't understand that even though we hold fast, even though that shows us something, even though that rolls up the blind and the sun comes through, the sun was there all the time, all the time. So this letting go, letting go. Can you let go when you're walking in Kinyin? When you hear the sound of the bird? When you smell the stick of incense on the altar? Does the stick of incense on the altar need you to be any particular way? Does it require you to be holding fast? Does it require you to tend? Does it require you to have no distractions, no concerns, no attachments, no bad habits? Let's say someone in this room had none of those things, and someone did. But if they both go, ah, incense smell. Now, we'll look at another koan involving Hogan. And this is an early koan from the Hekigan Roku. So this is case number 7, and the title goes like this. Echo asks about Buddha. So a monk asked Hogan, "My name is Echo. I ask you, what is Buddha?" Hogan said, "You are Echo." What is Buddha? It's holding fast. It's essential, holding fast. The question asked down to the bottom of your heart. What is Buddha? What is my Buddha mind? What is this no sound, smell, color, taste, touch, spacious mind? What is it? I want to see it directly. But that damn party crasher. So the monk brings this question because the party crasher keeps breaking up his focus, perhaps. He asked Hogan, "What is Buddha?" And Hogan said, "You are Echo." I remind you of the words of a young woman who was in the midst of a series of enlightenments. And she said, and I'll paraphrase it, "Just as I am, just exactly as I am perfectly. Just exactly as I am in this very moment, I am perfectly." I'll mention one other comment by another student who was involved in a process of awakening. He put it this way: I came to see clearly that just to be is a supremely total act. Do you have to be anything in particular to be? Does the incense stick have to be a particular kind of incense to be? Letting go is opening the gate widely, because you know what is important. You know that just to be is a supremely total act. When you know this really clearly, then you begin to get this first line of the four vows. All beings, however numberless, I vow to save them all. Saving this ghost. You couldn't save this ghost were it not already saved. So we'll end there today.